Hey gang, welcome to this week's episode of Ranching Reboot. This week, we've got a really great guest for you. He's got four generations of experience pasture finishing hogs. He sells to Charlie Trotters, world famous in Chicago. We talk about truth in labeling, and then we tackle one of our favorite subjects on Ranching Reboot podcast, meatpacker concentration. We talk about the velocity of money and how food security is national security. Today's guest is Greg Gunthorpe. Welcome Greg to the show. Greg, welcome to the show. And we'll just start off like we really haven't met. We've just exchanged a little bit over Twitter. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about yourself a little bit?
Sure. Great to be on today. Greg Gunthorpe, my family, wife and son, we own Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana. I grew up on a diversified crop and livestock farm. My parents still own it, butts up to our farm, about a 600 acre, corn, soybeans, wheat, alfalfa, actual diversified, crop and livestock farm, finished some, cattle until 1985. And, my family's, farrowed, pigs on pasture for at least four generations, sold them on the commodity market until, 1998. And just a few years before that, 94, my wife and I just newly married. My dad said that the hog market was done for the independent small hog farmer, said that it's time to sell the sows. I said I wasn't ready to quit raising hogs. And so me and my wife went off on our own. 1998, found out my dad was right. The market for the independent hog farmer was done. My wife and I sold live pigs for less than what my grandpa sold them for in the Depression. We netted 5 cents a pound on one potload of hogs by the time they took trucking and insurance and docked us. What little equity we had, we lost in 98. And I still said that I'm not ready to be done raising pigs. And I said, you know, I'd spent a summer in England and Scotland right after I'd graduated 1988 with the FFA and the Young Farmers of the United Kingdom, and stayed on a couple. I stayed on 11 different farms, but a couple of them were direct marketing back in 88. And I kind of thought it was crazy at the time that they were making their living selling at farmers markets and selling to chefs and selling to other individuals. I thought, man, that looks like way too much work. But I got to see that kind of firsthand. And in 1998, when we got nothing for our pigs, I thought, you know, maybe we can eke out a living if I can make some connections with some chefs in the big city. And a little bit of luck and a little bit of fate, we sold our first pig to a restaurant in September of 1998. Got more for that one pig than was getting for whole truckloads of them at the time. And as luck would have it, the place that we started was Charlie Trotter in Chicago. And, you know, I was just a farm boy from Northeast Indiana. I didn't know who Charlie Trotter was. I wasn't connected to the foodie world. But Wine Spectator magazine that same month rated him the number one restaurant in the world for food and wine. So, like I said, a little bit of luck and a little bit of fate. We started at the top. And once you were selling pigs to Charlie Trotter, it's just kind of grown word of mouth from there. You know, other people wanted to try it. A couple years later, we made a really good connection with Chef Rick Bayless, Frontier Grill. He's been our largest customer for about 20 years. And up until COVID came, you know, we were rolling along pretty decent, because the, you know, the we'd actually, you know, there's a sizable group. It's not huge, but there's a sizable group of direct marketers in the country. And I think we'd finally made enough splash that we woke the big guys up. And, you know, the I always tell people they've co-opted virtually every message from every niche that we've produced. And without really making any meaningful changes, they've started stepping into our market. And about 2015 on, it's kind of got a lot more difficult to be a niche producer, but it's been an amazing journey. You know, we're still raising pastured pigs. We got some pastured poultry on the farm, still raising turkeys. We got some sheep this year. My family, my dad and grandpa sold the ewes in 1968, 2 years before I was born. Me and my son brought them back this year. So we're out here having fun, have a USDA inspected processing plan on the farm. You know, our customer bases, some online retailers, restaurants, some universities, some other meat shops.
Truly diverse.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
So,
We're definitely unique because there's not very many of us little integrated operations, you know, and we jumped off the cliff in 98. And like I said, it's been an amazing journey. It's not been simple at all. But, you know, it's I would do it again. I'd love to do it again because we made some big mistakes through the process, but we survived some.
You mentioned that the Packers are the big guys were starting to invade and cut into some of your niches. How is that working? How are they doing that?
We got ran out of the commodity market in 98. And I feel like that in some days I wake up and feel like what we did was just take on an awful lot more risk to have the commodity guys try to run us out of this. And, you know, if you go into the conventional grocery store, and I consider Whole Foods as conventional grocery store. So any grocery store you go into, it's just about impossible to find meat or poultry that doesn't have what I call like to call fluffy labels on it, whether it's natural, whether it's, you know, cage free, whether it's antibiotic free, whether it's grass fed, whether it's you name it. There's a label on virtually all local, you name it. And there's only a handful of producers like us in the whole country. I was arguing with somebody on Twitter the other day and said it was half a dozen. And when we got all said and done, and I realistically guess it's probably closer to two dozen in the country. So it's maybe 25 producers around the United States that are actually what the consumer thinks that they're getting. Most of that, you know, every one of those things I mentioned, cage-free, organic, cage-free organic eggs, 10% of those come from one farm about 100 wow. miles north of us that has about 1 million hens. Nobody that's buying cage-free organic eggs thinks they're getting hens from a farm that right. has 1 million hens. I mean, not a single person thinks that. Or organic milk. We just seen last week the that whole group out in the Northeast that's got their pink slips. They're getting cut off from organic milk. In a year from Danone, from Horizon. You know, we all know that that's because they've got 10 and 20,000 cow confinement organic dairies that don't even come close to meeting the Code of Federal Regulations in Chapter 7 for the grazing requirements. Organic cows are supposed to get 30% of their diet direct, actually harvested from grazing.
How are they getting away with it?
You know,
there's loopholes and so that's like my biggest concern with the organic labeling is it's really misled what the intentions of the whole label were, right?
You know, I'm not going to get too terribly political. I like to get a little political okay. at times, but,
you can if you want.
We love doing that here. So yeah.
I always tell people the Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, the USDA, they've really been on vacation on all these issues since the 1970s. And it's been both sides of the aisle. When you get all said and done, labeling laws in this United States are go to the biggest bidder. We have agency capture issues in all of our federal government, and they've largely been able to either write the labeling laws or they've been able to convince those guys on how they interpret the labeling laws. So, you know, the some of those organic dairies consider grazing as the, as far as I can tell, the, you know, they're sprouting that fodder. They're calling that cows grazing. No one that buys organic milk thinks that taking small grains, adding water to it and letting it sprout is a cow grazing. I mean, come on, that's just absolute bullshit. But, you know, if you have a organic standard that's owned by the USDA and it becomes the lowest common denominator of who will certify what. And there's some certifiers out there that are just absolutely questionable, but it's not just organics. It's everything. The virtually no one realizes that if you go to the grocery store and buy grass-fed beef, even with a product of the USA label on it, 85% of that is foreign beef.
Australian.
Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, because it's able to be packaged in the United States. That's what they convinced the USDA that's the production is the packaging. That's a bunch of bullshit too. I mean, excuse my language, but that's not what anybody thinks, you know? So, I mean, the natural, that is completely worthless on a meat and poultry label. Cause that, you know, you can even read from the asterisk. That just means it's minimally processed. All meat and poultry meets the natural definition by USDA, yet Consumer Reports says 34% of people buying that think that it means that it's organic. So, I mean, it's all, that's why I say the big packers have stepped into that. You live in Colorado, virtually all local beef comes from Aspen Ridge, which is JBS's 100,000+ feedlot. Nobody thinks JBS with 100,000+ steers on feed is local, but that's what local is if you're in Colorado. So, I mean, it's right. Small farmers can't compete in the retail space. So just like us, you know, even if you're, you know, we've sold as much as 1 million pounds of pastured pork and poultry a year, and you have to go around the big guys, you know, you have to sell in places that they either can't or won't, and we'll never rebuild local and regional food systems until we actually have access to the market.
So how, like, okay, so those places where the big guys can't or won't sell, what are some of those places, and how are you getting in there?
You know, we largely, especially pre-COVID, we largely built our market around the, you know, I tell people we're selling the ultimate dining experience. We raise a Duroc and a Duroc Berkshire crossbred pig, significantly higher meat quality than the conventional pig. Raised on pasture, processed here on the farm, delivered fresh to a restaurant. The big guys can't compete with that on a flavor standpoint, can't compete right. with that on a freshness standpoint. So, you know, there's some chefs out there that really appreciate what we do in that regards. And like I said, the big guys can't compete on that. So, you know, if we're not just competing on price, and we're instead completing on service and quality, we have a chance of selling to restaurants. You know, and we seen last week, I'm sure you guys followed Herzog's, you know, quality and service. Quality and service, you know, and they're an excellent example of it. And we've seen it so many times over the years. You know, our best customers are ones where the chef is also the owner. And so, you know, he's the one that makes the final decision, because otherwise you deal with something that's a big chain or a big group or whatever. You can have the greatest relationship with the chef, but you got to have every single person above them in their chain of command that's also on board with buying from you, because it only takes one of them to kick you out the door. Takes all of them for you to stay there.
The bigger that organization gets above the chef that wants the quality food, the less likelihood there is that they're probably going to buy it, because more people, you know, more management above that level means they're more concerned with profit than with quality.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality is they can buy something else in the marketplace. It comes back to what we were just talking about. They can buy something else in the marketplace that's got some fancy label on the package, and they're say, oh yeah, this stuff is really better, but you know, this over here is only 25% over commodity price, because that's what most of the big guys get for those fancy labeled stuff, is 25 to 40% over commodity for doing basically nothing. And we can't compete against that. Mm-hmm. And so you get kicked out the door. And so it's like a big roller coaster ride. And then that manager goes away, and you talk to the chef and you get back in the door. Yeah, start over again.
Yeah. So is that like one of the biggest barriers for, so I actually just looked you up on Twitter. So I'd get kind of an idea of what you're into. But you had mentioned like competing for retail space. And I think, is that one of the biggest barriers of getting retail space, is talking to the actual decision makers of the board and getting approval? Or is it because these big commodity guys can offer this weird scale that isn't necessarily the greatest quality?
Yeah, I mean, it mostly comes down to price and supply. You know, they don't want to deal with a bunch of smaller producers, even though they give the impression, you know, I don't like to beat up on Whole Foods, but, you know, most everybody understands that Whole Foods, you know, has made their market on claiming that they're buying from small family farms. But, you know, they don't want to deal with a bunch of small family farms. They want to deal with a couple outlets for their supply, you know, and we can't compete on
convenience, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's a lot more work to have a local and regional food system. And it's a lot more work. And, you know, that's where we've found some chefs that make it work and that are willing to put in the effort. And when we started, we kind of stayed away from retail mostly. And, you know, we pursued a little bit of retail direct to individuals, but we couldn't get the volume that we needed because we made that necessary step of building a processing plant. We needed enough volume to run through our processing plant. And our easiest way to get some volume was to work with a handful of chefs rather than working with thousands of individual customers. Some days I wonder whether that was the right decision or not, but you know, it is what it is.
If you had to do your meat plan again, would you, or would you do it differently?
Is a necessary evil to do what we do. But if there was processing, and especially if we could have got processing done at someone that was at a slightly larger scale than us, we'd have been better off doing that. But at the time, that probably would have been AMPAC in Chicago or something like that, which didn't survive. So we'd have probably been in a world of hurts anyways. And, you know, realistically, to sell to restaurants, we'd have never been able to do what we did without us actually having the flexibility of raising or lowering the number of animals we processed each week and cutting each and every one of them to a bunch of different restaurants the way they wanted them cut and the way they wanted them packaged. So yeah, we'd probably build the processing plant again, but it's some days it's more headaches than others. And right now with the whole labor situation, it's pretty rough owning a little processing plant.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Are you having trouble getting guys to cut and package, or are you having getting inspectors?
I probably bash USDA Food Safety Inspection Service probably as much as anyone in the whole country. And I think the Secretary Vilsack and the administrator, Mr. Kicker and all that, they would probably put me on that list right up there at the top. But one thing I always say good about USDA is that I think in our 17 or 18 years here at the farm that we've had USDA inspection, I think there's only ever been one time that we wanted to slaughter that we didn't have an inspector. And that was one that literally walked off our line when his 12 hours was up and didn't even tell us that, you know, because we would have probably just stopped so that if he absolutely had to go home. But other than that, we've always got an inspector. So we've been fortunate in that regard. Now, sometimes we get some crazy ones. I always like to talk about that there's two groups of there's actually three groups. There's the sane and reasonable group, which I think makes up about 80% of USDA. And then you got the ones on the one end, I like to call them the lazies. And you got the ones on the other end that are the crazies. And, you know, they can definitely make your life really interesting. And, you know, the unintended consequence of regulations and food safety standards is that it costs substantially more for a little operation to deal with them than it does a big operation. But, you know, we do, when you get all said and done, I don't know that I can really argue about or say that there was any one specific food safety regulation that I would want gone. I think that there's been some times that we definitely have a different interpretation than some of what USDA, but I think we'd be largely operating in the same manner, whether we had USDA. Now, employee-wise, I don't think most people realize that even when labor is not tight, it's really, really difficult to staff a slaughter plant. There's a large percentage of our population yes. that is not going to work in a slaughter plant, no matter what. And, you know, I think part of that is that we're just so far removed and so far disconnected from our food supply. I think part of that is a misconception of what people think happens mm-hmm. in very small slaughter plants. Because, you know, we get our chefs and customers come out all the time, and a lot of them say, man, I was expecting it to be a lot more gross than that. I was expecting it to be more violent. I was expecting, you know, they list off bunches of things, and, you know, it's not that. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's parts of a slaughter plant and a processing plant that's too cold, too hot, too wet, too dry. I mean, you're dealing with live animals. It's dirty. It's difficult work. Everything that we do on the farm and everything we do on the processing plant is hard work. And, you know, there's large portions of our society that is not hard work anymore. So, yeah. You know, and I think farms and processing plants, but I think slaughter plants in general have a more difficult time on staffing. And when, you know, there just aren't enough people to go around, it gets really, really scary to own a slaughter plant when, you know, they can go make as much money flipping burgers as you can afford to pay. And, you know, it's definitely an uncertain time.
And then, you know, you have a pipeline of animals coming in because you're scheduled, yeah. you know, you're scheduled so far out. Do you just do your own stuff, or do you do stuff for other folks?
No, we, one of our flexes, after COVID was that, we've started to process pigs for other people. We always, chose in the past not to do it mainly over, biosecurity issues, but we put some changes right. in place. And, you know, and especially since the shortages was so bad, everywhere, we slaughter and process some pigs for some other people now. And that actually, works out quite well. We used to try to slaughter some chickens for other people, and the labor requirements on, poultry is so much higher per pound than pigs. And that never really worked. We quit doing chickens this year. We did pastured chickens, about 120,000 of them a year until this year. And
what's the main thing? Is it the feathers
we're actually really, really good at scalding and plucking them. So the feathers was never really a huge issue. The big problem is that, you know, the bird weighs, it's just the physics of it. The bird weighs, you know, 4.5-6 pounds, and there's still tasks that you have to do on that. And at our scale, we couldn't justify the millions of dollars worth of equipment to do that with machines. So our chicken line would take 20 to 22 people on the line to do about the exact same number of pounds of chickens in a morning that we can do with 7 or 8 people on our pig line. So, you know, we have just way, way more dollars in processing in chicken. And when you get all said and done, you have chicken, and the this whole industrialization of our food supply goes down a path. And I don't think most of us ever, you know, we talk about it, but I don't think we really stop and think about it. The chicken industry has done one thing really, really well, and I actually hate them for it, but they've made chicken really, really cheap. And when you make chicken really, yes. really cheap, there's absolutely no way for a small operation that wants to do something by hand, raise them where the chicken actually ought to be, where, you know, gets to scratch on the ground, gets to chase a few bugs, gets to actually see the sun. You can't afford to do that because when you get all said and done, the American people still think that chicken should be cheap, and pastured chicken should cost as much as beef or pork because it costs as much to produce. But people are like, no matter where we sold it, it still had to be the cheapest item.
They removed
the cheapest right. item on the menu. Yep.
Well, before John Tyson figured it out, chicken was one of the most expensive meats.
Yep.
Really?
Oh, I didn't know that. Back in the 20s and 30s, Depression era, nobody ate chicken. I mean, the farmers ate chicken because that's, you know, they always had chickens, but nobody in the cities was eating chicken.
You know, you guys know Will Harris, White Oaks pastor?
Yeah.
Every once in a while, he sends me a screenshot from history. I think the one is from like 1916, a menu, and the chicken was more expensive than the beef on the menu in 1916.
That's wild.
Will Harris, hopefully another future guest on the Ranching Reboot podcast.
Will and his southern drawl, I think that you could listen to him for an hour, read the phone book.
When I met Will, it was out at the Regenerate Conference in 2019. And I don't know if I've told this story on air before or not, but we'd just come out of a big session and I saw Will Harris. I went up and I introduced myself and I started talking to him, and then up walks Mike Calicrate. And if you can imagine Will and Mike Calicrate for an hour and a half, I just stood there just soaking it all in. I mean, those two guys are legends.
I think that if I'm not mistaken, I think I spoke at that conference. And I think I had lunch with Mike right before I went up and spoke. I should send you the link to that sometime, because I kind of told some interesting stories about Mr. Almanza and JBS and him going to take that job and everything. It was a pretty interesting talk. Mike got me kind of wound up before I went up on stage.
I was going to say, did he get you fired up before you had to get Mike, up and talk? Because I could totally see that.
Mike is really, really good about that. Yep.
Oh, yeah. I was like, he was our fourth episode when we started the podcast. And I like thought about it for weeks. I was like, Brian, I can't stop thinking about everything he said.
Mike and Will are both really, really good friends. I've known both of them for a long time, been out to both of their places. Mike's been here to the farm several times.
And you guys definitely see eye to eye about, you know, meat packer concentration and the lack of market transparency and why that's such a bad thing.
Yeah. See the, I see just about completely eye to eye with, Mike. You know, Will's, got a scaled enough operation that I think he's, virtually gave up on the fact that there'll ever be a competitive commodity market again. But I see the same as Mike, because I don't know that we'd ever go back to the commodity market because we chose a different route. But I still don't think that long-term niche producers survive or survive well without there being a fair and competitive commodity market. You know, because it comes back to that same thing, the problem we had with the chickens. If the other product is so dirt cheap and has no value to any consumer anywhere, it's really, really difficult to sell something that does have some value, that has some real, true, actual costs in it.
Instead of trying to externalize the cost or exploit cheap labor and cheap grain somewhere else.
Right.
So let's talk about supply chains. Are you experiencing a lot of supply chain disruptions? Are you seeing a lot of that? Any of that stuff on your radar?
You know, you see it everywhere, but you know, we're kind of fortunate in that I think we don't have serious problems in it. Like the materials for the plant, we buy our packaging materials several months at a time, so I don't think we're having problems there. We have a really antiquated and probably too many tractors on the farm that so we don't have parts and issues like that. We don't really have a lot of specialty equipment per se, you know, don't raise much crops. So we're not really seeing much supply chain issues. Now, everything's going through the roof on costs of everything that we use, but now I think that
like fertilizer and, you know, fertilizer. I saw the other day where China said they're not going to export any phosphate in 2022, which that's 40% of our phosphate supply for fertilizer.
You know, the one that scares me a little bit, you know, the We still feed a fair amount of corn, you know, because our pigs and our poultry aren't ruminants. So we have to feed some corn.
Right.
And the I'm starting to hear an awful lot of farmers talk about their anhydrous and their nitrogen costs. And I haven't really tracked it completely, but they're talking about double and triple the cost. You know, I got a good enough understanding of crop production. I know that they can probably skimp for a while on their phosphorus and their potassium and still come up with these trend line yields. Our U.S. corn supply without nitrogen, those boys don't know how to raise corn without nitrogen. We don't have a corn crop if we don't have anhydrous and nitrogen in the United States. Because, you know, we want to talk about resiliency. We don't have any resiliency in the meat and poultry industry because of, you know, we slaughter almost all the cattle in 27 plants in 13 states, 85 or 86%. We slaughter 90 some percent of the pigs in about 40 plants in this country. We raise all of this corn to feed the non-ruminant animals, and it's hand to mouth on nitrogen needs, and it's all propped up by huge amounts of inputs. And man, they just plain won't do it without nitrogen. And at some point, you know, and I guess the in the grain farmers' defense, they've been really good for decades about continuing to produce corn and soybeans, whether they make any money or not. So I guess maybe they'll continue to go on, because that's just the history of crop farming in the United States.
You know, so like corn farming, I think the number is 96-97% of the acres planted of corn is not for human consumption. And, you know, then you can further break that down and say, well, there's a lot that go to biofuels and there's some that go to corn oil and, you know, but yeah, a lot of it does go to livestock feed. And is it an efficient use of land? Maybe. Does it grow a lot per acre? Yeah. But what's the cost? What's the input cost? What do we need to haul? You know, and how much fossil fuel does it take? You know, because a lot of those fertilizers come from natural gas as a raw feedstock. And how much of those fertilizers does it take, and how much energy is it taking to actually grow this crop? And are we getting ahead by using it as biofuel at all? You know, those are some of the real questions I have.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of, I guess, as most people probably figured out, I'm probably a little radical and probably don't normally always fit in rural America too well. But, you know, the rough numbers, and you want to really fire up corn and soybean farmers, the rough numbers with my calculations is somewhere around 10,000 miles per acre, planting corn, turning it into ethanol, putting it into a gas car. That same acre of land is about 750,000 miles with solar panels as a solar farm running through an electric car. So, I mean, it's, you know what, 7,500 times more efficient to take those same land, you know, but farmers are like, oh man, we can't take any of this land away because we need to continue to raise corn. We take 40 some percent of the corn, turn it into ethanol. And the best study you can find is about 1.35 units of energy produced for every unit of energy that went into producing the corn.
I mean, think that's a bullshit number. I think it's negative.
You think it's, it wouldn't surprise me, but, you know, in lots of ways, isn't our, the CAFO industry, the confinement livestock industry, isn't the feedlots, isn't the ethanol industry really just to deal with the fact that we've had massive overproduction in agriculture for decades. And we've propped it up because they had to do something with this corn instead of just piling it up everywhere and letting it rot. So they turned it into ethanol. They raised more pigs that the Chinese and the Brazilians own export to somewhere. That is just a really, really fragile system that has just economically gutted rural America. The economic metrics of rural America look worse than the inner cities. And yet they're just saying, oh, this is all grand and we're feeding the world. we're feeding the world, but we're not even feeding the farmers in rural America.
And you know, you touched on something about that we're taking these pigs that are owned by foreign interests. We're going to run them through a slaughterhouse that's owned by foreign interests, and we're feeding them corn and soybeans that's heavily subsidized by the American taxpayer just so meat can be cheap. But what's just right under the surface is that all these meat packers, and I'll call them out, Smithfield, JBS, Monfort, they're all owned by either Brazil or China. And that's where all our subsidies are going. That's where the crop subsidies that the government pays farmers, they end up in the bank accounts of the big packers.
Right. I mean, it's real easy to connect the dots, but you know, enough people's pockets are getting lined that we as a society choose not to connect the dots.
And it's weird. It's like we almost have blinders on, and you got to wonder why aren't people talking about these things? You know, why has this all been buried? Why isn't this on front page news? Meat packers make billions to overseas investors while American ranchers starve.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really good question because, you know, some of us talk about it, but it doesn't feel like the, you know, and I don't feel like that when we talk to consumers or taxpayers or the average American, you know, everybody, except for a handful of farmers that think they're going to be the last one standing, everyone else agrees with what we say. But, man, it's really hard to get enough momentum to actually get states and Washington, D.C. to really do something different about it. And I think a lot of it comes back to that whole that I mentioned before, agency capture. You know, these corporations have some really powerful people in some really high places. And our government, on virtually every decision, makes choices that are contrary to the interest of independent family farms. And they've done it for decades, and they just continue to do it.
Well, I think we've done a great job of kind of laying out the problem. So how do we fix it?
You know, I tell people, I think we got to do four things. I think we have to start with subsidy reform. We have to quit encouraging through subsidies the industrialization of agriculture and the, you know, the proliferation of money going towards just a handful of people. The subsidies need to be about real food rather than just corn and soybeans if there's going to be subsidies. So we need subsidy reform. We need labeling reform. People need to be able to go into the marketplace and they need to be able to trust what is on that package. You know, rattled off a whole bunch of them, but you know, whether it's natural, whether it's organic, grass-fed, gestation crate-free, you name it, cage-free. People, if they're going to spend a premium for it, and this is in the interest of both niche and commodity producers, that those are actually transparent and meaningful, because they harm both the niche and the commodity producers, because they clearly take away part of our demand, but they're also harming the commodity producers because it's just another step in this progression where they take commodity products. The packer and the retailer get a premium for it. The commodity producer gets zero premium for that. We need antitrust enforcement. We need the Federal Trade Commission, Department of Justice, the Packer and Stockyards Administration. They actually have to do their job. There's glaring examples, you know, the sheep slaughter plant out in Colorado last year, JBS, the largest importer of lamb into the United States, buys up a sheep slaughter plant with the sole intention of shuttering it for sheep slaughter. It had the capacity to slaughter about 20% of the lambs in the Western United States. Is no longer a lamb slaughter plant. JBS didn't buy that for financial interest to own that plant. They bought that in their financial interest to get rid of competition. We have laws on the books, Clayton Act, Sherman Act, Packer and Stockyards Act, that make it clear that we actually need competitive markets in this country, and that we're not supposed to allow individual corporations to get big enough to make decisions that could impact the market. Every single one of those four corporations that you mentioned before are big enough that their individual decisions impact the marketplace. We have packing plants that are big enough that whether there's a fire, whether there's Russian hackers, whether there's COVID issues, one plant has an impact on the marketplace. We're a smart enough and an affluent enough society that we should not have allowed that to happen. And we're an affluent and smart enough society that we should go in a separate direction. Food security is national security, and we have to enforce antitrust laws. They're on the books. It's time that the Federal Trade Commission, Department of Justice, and the USDA goes back to work. And then the final thing is that we need some inspection reform. Small plants, very small plants especially, if they're going to get a chance to operate and function, they have to have a reasonable inspection, and there has to be some safeguards in place for when they get both of them, for the consumer and the plant standpoint. Those crazies and those lazies that I like to talk about in inspection. USDA Food Safety Inspection Service is expending a huge amount of resources for modernization of poultry and pork, and they're working on beef. And they're doing that to cut their labor force. But the biggest reason that they're doing that is that they're doing that because this new inspection systems makes it so the lines more consistently run at full and even faster line speeds. They won't tell anybody but that, but that's the realistic reason. They have staffing issues, so they eliminate part of the staffing issues by making the plant do part of the inspection. And if they don't have as many employees show up under the old inspection systems, like poultry, for example, every inspector that didn't show up, the plant had to run 35 birds less per minute. Under the new inspection system, the plant's the one that has to do that inspection. They just have an inspector at the end of the line. They can be 50% short staffed and the plant's still running at full speed. Before, if they'd have been 50% short staffed, the plant would have run at 50%. So the new inspection systems are really about making sure that the new plants can run at full speed. They're putting in virtually no effort to make it so that we have more resilient, robust, and appropriate. They're putting in no effort at all to make it so that we have resilient, robust, and appropriate inspection systems for little plants. Their answer always for why there isn't little plants is that these people just need more resources. We actually have the resources available now. There's groups like the Niche Meat Processors Assistance Network, lots of the extension services. The available resources for little plants are much greater now. Talk about my plant, for example, compared to the modern inspection plant. We get three USDA inspectors a day, one full-time, one that's at our farm 8 hours a day. The veterinarian that's on a patrol, he normally shows up for a couple hours a day. And then we run a second processing shift, so we get a patrol inspector for a couple hours there. The one of the modern pork inspection plants, 35 miles up the road, that does 8,000 to 11,000 pigs a day, they get four inspectors. We get three.
I'm serious.
And you know, the
that's why the rules favor the big guys.
Well, you know, and there's a certain amount. No matter how small you get, there's still a certain amount of inspection that is required. But, you know, my argument would be that USDA has completely dragged its feet over this cooperative state inspection system. That was initially in the 2002 Farm Bill. USDA finally promulgated regulations so that there could be a cooperative state inspection plant. And that's where a state inspected plant can use a federal legend and can sell across state lines. They finally did that in 2014. So it was They were told to do it in 2002 Farm Bill. They got around to it in 2014. On the modern inspection stuff, they were told not to do it. And they had five plants that they were allowed to do for a pilot project. They added the plant down the road here as number six when they were told by Congress not to add anymore. So, you know, their attitude is that let's go out of our way to make it easier for, and I wouldn't necessarily say easier. They want to go out of their way to make it so that the big guys' cost of production is lower and they're more consistently able to run. I think they go out of their way on the opposite end to make it so that the little guys' cost of production is higher and we're not consistent. And I think that they need to level that playing field as much as they need to worry about the leveling the food safety playing field.
You know, you're right. I can't disagree, but I can also see that this is a case where they've kind of done the minimum necessary to keep, right, to keep food flowing. Because like you said, food security is national security. The only thing scarier to the government than a Bible thumping Republican that has a gun is one that's hungry. I mean, you take away people's food for just a couple of days and they're going to get upset and real fast. So like food riots is the one thing the government wants to avoid at all costs. That means we've got to keep the meat supply flowing.
Right. But at some point, and you know, before COVID, I was probably one of those tinfoil cap paranoid conspiracy theory people when I was talking to people saying, you know, the big cities really only have 3 days, 72 hours worth of food supply. And if this food supply doesn't keep cranking, you literally could run out of food in the grocery store. You know, before 2020, people looked at you and said, you're nuts. Now they're like, what was this Greg saying over here? Because, you know, that's a reality. And, you know,
where do I go to learn how to plant a garden?
Right. Up to a certain point, this whole idea of industrialization, specialization, you know, it's extremely efficient and productive when it's all working. But up to a certain point, I believe that they finally somewhat realized that you can go too far pushing that whole cheap food and scale.
Big is fragile.
To the point it becomes fragile. And then it's no longer long-term. It's not cheap, efficient, secure food. And we've got to that point as a country to where food, when it's working, is really, really cheap, really, really efficient. And now we can argue all day, and I'd be on the side arguing that that has huge amount of hidden costs, not good for the animal, not good for
people. Yeah, look at the health of the average American.
Not good for rural America, all of that stuff. But that argument never really got very far with people. But nowadays, most people realize when you start talking about it, we should not have let foreign entities own and control our food supply. We should not have allowed it to become so consolidated, so industrialized to the point that it's no longer secure. And people realize it's no longer secure.
You know what? It was about a month ago. There was a couple cases of BSE in Brazil. Barely heard a peep about it in our news, but China overnight shut down beef imports from Brazil. They had a case, I think, 2 weeks ago. I think that was in Britain. Do you remember, CK?
Yes. It was in England. It was in Britain, yep.
Yeah. Barely heard a blip about it on the news. You know, 7 years ago, the cow that killed Christmas, you know, that didn't even get into the food supply, but that tanked our cattle market. You know, like... Mm-hmm. Is there any consistency? Is there anything that you can point to that says, no, the cattle market's not fraudulent or it's actually working like it should? Or is it just a totally, totally fraudulent system?
Oh, it's a fraudulent system. The largest processor of beef in the United States is a criminal organization.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people all the time, we have laws in this country. And in fact, I'll share with you on Twitter afterwards, I got a letter back from the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service, because I've been hounding them for years. The Meat and Poultry Act does not allow convicted felons to be in the meat business in the United States. They actually enforce.
Oh, yes, really?
Really? They actually enforce it on small and very small plants.
Batista brothers have never been convicted in the U.S. court.
You sound just like Mr. Kicker. You sound just like the undersecretaries. Every time I told them that, up until October of 2020, they've been convicted. Then they finally got convicted over that rotten beef and the fraud and the bribery in a U.S. court. And they also got convicted over price fixing in a U.S. court. I immediately sent off a letter to the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service administrator, because they told me, I bet you they told me 20 times, Greg, yes, but our laws do not cover felonies in foreign countries. Well, then they had felonies in the United States. I got this long letter back. They're supposedly investigating it, but I don't know. You know, I think it's difficult to point to there not being fraudulent activities that go on in the meat industry, because there are. The largest processor of beef in the United States has a track record around the globe of convicted felonies. I mean, we have laws. We're not supposed to have that.
Billions in fines and bribery charges.
We just choose not to enforce it. I do think one thing that the other point I like to make about what's going on in the beef industry now is I'm sure you guys have all heard it before. You know, when I told people that we ought to have more packing plants, we ought to actually have more farmers in the United States. We ought to have a larger percentage of our production coming from niche producers direct to consumers. The answer always from the Farm Bureau types and the industrial food types was that the American consumer cannot afford that we need cheap food. Well, that's not accurate, because look at the spread right now between live beef and what the packers are getting for them. It's $700 to $1,000 been running. It ran a little bit higher than that. National beef's last quarter netted $700 per steer that they slaughtered. Small processing plants don't charge $700 for processing. So somebody's lying when they say that the American consumer can't afford the processing cost of very small processing in the U.S. The American consumer's paying it to the big packer and the big retailer right now. They can afford it. They're paying the bill.
Yeah, and I think Mike Calicrate even has data that shows that, like, his small plants are twice as efficient at breaking down meat per man as the big guys are.
Right.
You know, so it's not necessarily a matter of efficiency. It's just, you know, scale and minimizing that governmental, that regulatory compliance cost. And you know, so, to some degree, I guess if you're the Batista brothers, it's just another bribe away, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you know the story, but, you know, they bribed somewhere between 1,500 and 2,100 politicians and inspectors in Brazil. And we were the only developed country in the world that did not immediately cut off imports from Brazil when that bribery scandal broke. And I shit you not, 3 days after the person that made the decision in the United States to not cut them off, Al Almanza, the administrator for USDA Food Safety Inspection Service, 3 days after he retired, he took a $5 million signing bonus to go work for JBS as Global Quality Assurance Vice President. We have laws in this country for that too. 2 year, 4 year, and lifetime ethics rules on whether you can take those kind of jobs.
That's nowhere close to a conflict of interest.
We as a country didn't cut them off till Sonny Perdue was confirmed. Sonny Perdue cut them off. And why does everybody not just up in arms over that? That is not just a conflict of interest. That's criminal. I'm sure that if I run into Al Almanza somewhere, he's not going to like me, because I tell everybody he ought to be sitting in jail.
with the Batista brothers.
So what would happen? What would happen if the DOJ did crack down on them tomorrow and put the Batista brothers in jail? Do you think that would like it? Is there regulatory relief? Like, is there really anything that'll help the meat markets and dissolve these things? Do you have any hope that the government will actually use the weapons in their toolbox to, you know, to enforce Packers and Stockyard Act and antitrust rules?
You know, I have a little bit of hope. You know, we put a, as a country, we put a person in as the Federal Trade Commissioner chairman that I think she's going to do a wonderful job. We got a few people, Rohit is really strong on these issues. Both the president and the secretary have really, really strong concentration advisors in Tim Wu and Andy Green. You know, but we still got an awful lot up there that don't take these issues very serious. And I don't think we've got a Supreme Court. And I could be wrong, but I've never had any dealings with anyone at DOJ that really likes to get serious about these issues. But, you know, I think we already have one of the highest percentages of incarcerated populations in the world. Yes, we probably ought to add some money in the budget for more prisons if we're going to really go after the criminals in the meat business, because it's a lot of them.
Or let some of the...
What do you think it is? Is it just like because it's food, it's not that big of a crime? Like they're not weighing this as a huge injustice where they're weighting, you know, drugs and stuff like that. Like I'm just confused where the disconnect is.
I really think it comes back to that whole feed the world, cheap food policy. And I really think that they believe this is a necessary evil in order to feed society and keep the masses calm. And that, you know, if JBS is going to send a little bit of rotten beef to the United States, which was 11% rejected at the border, and normal percentage is 0.5% for paperwork. 11% is real food safety issues. You know, that kind of stuff just happens every once in a while. American
what
people
happened to you if 11% of the pork that went out of your door was wrong? You'd get shut down.
Yeah, we'd get shut down. And, you know, the that's one of the big differences. And that'd be one of the arguments for a more sane and reasonable inspection system on little processors, is that there's actually accountability when you know your end customers. I couldn't send a rotten product out. I would have no customer base. But, you know, if it's a nameless boxed product going somewhere else, you know,
we're really, sorry. We don't know how that slipped through.
Yeah.
We're sorry. Really, we'll never do that again.
Really any accountability in that? I mean, there really isn't any accountability in our system.
So how do you feel about traceability?
You know, the, my take on it from us personally, I think that traceability for what we do is absolutely essential. I think that a lot of these things that they're trying to push on to farmers and ranchers comes right back to that greenwashing, those labeling issues, the traceability, the round table for sustainable beef. They're just trying to pass costs off onto farmers and ranchers without paying them any kind of premium. And I think that's wrong. And I think that if we actually had a truly competitive market, farmers would get choices of who they would get to sell to. You know, in the hog industry, you can't sell pigs, commodity pigs, without your pork quality assurance level 3 certification. If there was more choices in packers, there would probably be packers that would pay a little bit less and say, hey, we don't care if you have that because we have a customer base that doesn't need it. But all of them get together and say, hey, you got to have that. None of them pay anything for it. It's just a necessary required evil, the traceability. And then the hypocrisy of the industry. You know, like they talk about what their traceability costs, but at the same time, you know, Proposition 12 is a good example. They're all up in arms over the giving gestating sows 24 square feet instead of 14 square feet. I think both of them are just way too few a square feet for a sow, because neither one of them, the sow doesn't get to express its natural instincts. But regardless, the industry always tells you, and you've seen it everywhere, that, oh, we know exactly where all this meat comes from. We can trace it all back, and we got 100% traceability. When they tell you that, hey, the you've got to segregate this pork to go to California versus not, they're like, oh, that's going to add too much cost to us. Like, you just got done telling us that you knew where every single bit of it was and you could track it all through the plant. Now you're saying it's going to cost too much to track it all through the plant. Which story is correct here? Because if it's going to cost you a lot more, you're not doing it now.
And I keep saying, shake the hand that feeds you. And it's an accountability thing, right?
Right.
You know, I'm not going to sell you rotten meat. You're not going to sell me rotten meat. You know, we're not going to grow and try to sell rotten vegetables. That's just, you know, that's not what people do. That's not what a person does to another person. Maybe a corporation might do that because some underling's just like, ah, I don't care. It's not my deal. We'll go ahead and ship that anyway. And there's no accountability. And the bigger a corporation or organization gets, the less clear that chain of accountability is.
Right.
So, you know, we're talking about cheap food. Let's talk about why that's such a bad thing, and how fragile is our food supply really?
I mean, the whole concept of cheap food, you know, food should be available to people, but this whole idea that it should be cheap was really not a wise plan. You know, like I said before, it's just gutted rural America economically. You know, I was raised as a pig farmer, so I like to talk about pigs more so than cattle. But when I was my son's age, there was 600,000 hog farmers in the United States. And I've got a degree in economics from Purdue University. Don't claim to be a economist, but I do have a degree in economics. And, you know, there's some terms that I think that we should all get familiar with. And one of them is the velocity of money. And there's been several studies, and, you know, I think we forget most of them now, but it was way more common that they were printed and shared a lot when the hog industry was actually consolidated. But the studies show that because of velocity of money, those family hog farms, those funds that came in for those pigs, those would circulate in that economy up to 7 times. You know, it went to Main Street, it went to the local hardware, it went to the feed mill, it went to farmers down the road that was growing the corn for the feed mill. You know, it went to, you name it. We actually had main streets, and we actually had rural communities when we had family farms. Now that money just is gone, because Smithfield, the largest owner of pigs in the United States, is a Chinese corporation. The second that those pigs are, they're just paying the farmer to raise them because they own the pigs. There's none of that economic activity taking place out here in rural America. China's the one benefiting from it now.
Instead, you know, of having 20 small family farms with a couple hundred pigs, you've got one mega farm that employs 2 people instead of 20 small family farms. And each one of those family farms is going to go into town. They're going to support the grocery store, the auto parts store, the dealer, the grocery store, all the small businesses in town that make a small business Main Street just hum. My friend Steve Stratford, he loves to say, cows build towns.
Yep.
And I don't want to exclude the pigs from that either, but, you know, to some extent, pigs build towns, cows build towns, right. Not in the finishing animals, the breeding animals. That's what you got to have to build the town.
Right. In our area, you know, we're in the Corn Belt. In our area, it was sows or milk cows. They built the towns. And when those disappeared, you know, it's kind of camouflaged how we've gutted rural America on the eastern side of the Corn Belt. It's much clearer on the western side of the Corn Belt because we still have lots of other people that live in rural America. Not as many because when I was in school, there was 140 in my class in school. My kids, there was 90 in classes. That's not as bad as the decline out in the western Corn Belt, but it's still a big decline. And it's only going to accelerate here as our rural communities get older and don't have as many kids. But, you know, it's we've lost huge amounts of our rural population. I tell people the most valuable things that we've sent off from the farm has been our topsoil and our kids. And we really ought to change both of those. But we ought to bring the sows back. And I think the only realistic way we can do it is they have to be direct marketed because there's not a realistic commodity market for independent hog farmers anymore. And we ought to bring the milk cows back. But that's getting destroyed now. My county is about half Amish. And we still have a bunch of small certified organic dairy farms, and they haven't told them that they're not picking up their milk, but they're running them out of business because these small dairies that are actually certified organic dairies, they can't compete with those 10 and 20,000 cow confinement dairies that are quote unquote organic by some certifiers. So, I mean, our community is going to be destroyed. The next county over from us, Steuben County, which is the farthest northeast county in Indiana. When I was young, there was 400 dairies in Steuben County. Some rolling ground. Guys added value to, you know, because they planted forages, turned it into milk, fed their cows, raised the family. Out of those 400, there's four left. 99% have disappeared in my lifetime. You know, the feed mills are disappearing. The main streets are gone. You know, so I mean, it's cheap food has real costs.
Real cost to rural America.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, the whole concept was it did not work out for consumers from a food quality, food choice, human health standpoint. Didn't work out for farmers or rural America at all.
And the whole myth that we're feeding the world, like that just it bothers me so much now when I hear. When I hear somebody say, oh, well, we're feeding the world. Like, okay, what are you getting ready to do? I'm getting my combine. We're going to go combine some soybeans. Right. Like, oh, you're feeding cows, maybe in another part of the world, but you know, those soybeans are probably going to feed cows, maybe pigs. How do we shift away from this mindset and start talk about what we're really growing in this country and what we're importing, and what we're exporting and becoming more self-sufficient, more food secure within our own borders?
You know, I think it's a lot easier conversation to have with people since the pandemic, but I still think it's we've got a lot of work to do to be able to create these local and regional food systems that actually feed people rather than this quote unquote feed the world. And you know, that whole feed the world thing is crazy anyways, because what we're really doing is sending raw commodities to other places that have money, because we're not sending food to people that really need it. You know, the Environmental Working Group has showed all of that. It's got some really interesting data of where we actually export to. The other thing is that these people don't want to talk about is that most years we're a net food importer. We're not feeding the world. We're, you know, and I live in Indiana, arguably one of the centrally located and one of the five bread baskets of the world. Indiana brings in 90% of the food that we eat in Indiana. We don't grow enough food here to say so. And we're one of the largest, most capable food producing areas in the world. You know, the why is that? And why aren't people really, really upset about that? People should be like, hey, especially since COVID, people should be, you know, we should take more of a European approach. We should value our farmers. We should value food. You know, too many people, you know, food is something that you stuff in your face after going through the fast food line. You know, we don't really sit down and enjoy food, or not enough anyways. And, you know, our whole attitude around food and our whole attitude around this feed the world and cheap food, all of that has to change some. And we have to actually value our rural communities, and our rural communities, unlike what the Farm Bureau and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, we truly need to connect with urban areas and connect with consumers. And it's the we need to listen to them, not their idea of that we need to preach to them that industrial ag is fine, because industrial ag's not fine. But they need us and we need them. It shouldn't be a controversy, and it shouldn't be an adversarial relationship like industrial ag likes to make it. You know, the our consumers, our customers really like us. They come out to the farm, you know, they're excited about food that tastes good, excited about food that's good for people. You know, the when's the last time you've seen anybody with the you know, you watch ag Twitter and all those ag advocates, they're fighting with consumers all the time, you know, trying to tell them, oh, this stuff we're doing is completely fine. That stuff we're doing is completely fine. We're really not, we don't have any impact in the fact that, you know, type 2 diabetes is like the highest percentage in the U.S. is anywhere in the world. And the fact that all of our rivers in all of these hog producing states aren't fit water to even have people in them. It's like, oh, that's not really us doing that. And it's like, it's probably got to be the geese. And, you know, it's like, come on, people. Do people really buy all those stories?
I think they do. You know, if you hear a lie repeated enough, you'll think it's true, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess the feed the world has been repeated enough. Farmers just say it like crazy. And, you know, you summed it up really well when you were talking about the whole connecting the dots between the fact that highly subsidized corn with confinement animals owned by the Chinese and the Brazilians to be exported, that we're largely just subsidizing foreign people's food and gutting rural America in the process.
Oh, but there's Dollar Generals popping up everywhere. Those are good jobs, right? I'm sure we're all on the Calicrate train about the Dollar General hate.
You can tell when the economic activity in your communities got really, really bad. The first thing they do is build a Dollar General. I think that's a sign that your community's in the tank.
You're in trouble.
Yep.
So, how do you feel about the food supply chains going into next year? Do you think we're going to continue to see these widespread supply chain disruptions with shortages in like ocean shipping, shortages in trucking? Like, the shortage isn't in trucking. Like, it's like not in goods. It's in actually moving the goods from either the port.
Logistics, right?
Yes, the logistics. Yeah. Like, there aren't enough truck drivers, aren't enough people to unload the ships. Like, do you think that's going to, do you think that's going to clear up soon, or do you think that's going to get worse?
Oh, I think it's going to get worse. And I think it's going to get worse because of partially because of labor. but I think it's going to get worse. The and it comes back to that whole concentration and consolidation, and where effective markets and where there's actually some competition in the marketplace. You have people that are, you know, wanting to grow their business, go out and get some more business. And I think the chicken industry right now is an excellent example. Those guys got really, really short on labor. And then they got really, really worried, because if you look at the biology, chickens are probably one of the riskiest when you have shortages at your processing plant, because Cornish cross chicken can gain a pound a week. So in 10 days of processing or 10 days of slaughter at the plant, the chicken goes from being too small to way too big. So if your plant's closed down for a few days, you never get caught back up on chickens. You know, cattle, yeah, it takes a long time to get caught back up, but you're not euthanizing cattle. Pigs, they euthanize some of them, but you got a little bit bigger window. And after the chicken industry did that for a while, I'm 100% convinced that they figured out, hey, we don't have to try to cut each other's throats. Let's just keep telling the world we don't have enough chicken and just keep jacking the price up. Chicken, those guys are making an awful lot of money now too, not even raising as many chickens and not running their plants full. And I don't think they have any desire to go back to full speed. We get the hog and the industry to the same way. They'll do the same thing. The packers are doing it right now on the beef, you know, with their margins. You know, they're coming up with they're using COVID. They're using every other kind of excuse. Some of it's real supply
plant chain fire, right. Cyber attack.
Right. Some of it is real supply chain issues, and it's really hard to decipher. And as you get industries that are way too consolidated, you know, we come right back to that thing of one individual entity can make decisions that is in their best financial interest to not do something rather than to do something. And so is it all supply chain issues, or is it too much concentration? We learned from history, we should never let it get this concentrated, and supply chain issues are going to be a problem, but concentration is a bigger issue.
Oh, but it'll be different this time, right? It'll be different.
Yeah.
That's always the human condition trap. It'll be different next time. We're smarter than we were then. It'll be different next time.
Yeah.
So, well, Greg, it's it's kind of flown by. Is there anything you want to know from me or CK, since this is our first time together?
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Yeah. What is it that you do out there now? Your Twitter handle is what? Red Hill Rancher?
Yeah, Red Hills Rancher. That's, you know, pretty consistent across all the social media. We do the podcast under Ranching Reboot. I guess I can tell a little bit of my story for those that don't know. I am part owner and operator of a 7,000-acre cattle ranch. It's all native range. I operate at fairly high stock densities, frequent moves. I run some of my own cattle. Mostly I run custom cattle through the summer. I keep my own through the winter. I've got some custom cattle coming in this winter as well. And I run Corriente and Longhorn cross cattle. I'm crossing with beef bulls with Angus this generation. And I've got some other bulls thinking about for the next couple generations. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. Family, my dad took over this place in, I think, 85. I came back from the Navy in 2006, started my grazing business in 2008. And by 2011, I was kind of running the whole place. And since 2016, I've been running it pretty much one hand, single-handed.
How long is your grazing season out there?
I'm on green grass from about April 15th to October 15th. So I get... Okay. A good solid 180 days of good green, good green grass. And I'll get a lot of cool season growth through the winter time too. So there's only about
there's about 45 days in the late summer, early fall, and there's another 60 to 70 days in the winter where it's too cold to grow anything.
Okay. And no sheep, all cattle.
No sheep, all cattle. Pretty sure the ranch was paid for with sheep back in the 30s because it has some sheep fencing on it. Like,
okay.
There's quite a bit of page wire fencing on it. And some of the urban legends and family legends say that the family paid for a lot of it with sheep back in the 30s.
You put 100 cattle guys in a room, you'll normally have 100 guys that would never have sheep on their farm, right?
Oh, it's funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
We really like ours. It's weird. My dad and grandpa sold theirs and sold the ewes in 1968. My dad still cusses about the things. And I think these new fence chargers and black plastic pipe and them being hair sheep and not turning the rams in so that they don't lamb before the middle of April. I mean, we made a lot of drastic changes compared to what they did back in the day. And they've honestly been really, really enjoyable. And, you know, that's a market where there's many buyers and many sellers, and sheep are actually bring decent money.
As making money. Animals,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of, we've got sheep now, so maybe that'll probably change, but you know, watch the market, will collapse now, but it's been fun to watch.
Sheep and goats are, you know, they're pretty consistent. They're pretty good money makers, from what I understand.
That's what I'm hearing from everyone who's got cattle enterprises and sheep and goat. They're like, the sheep and goats are paying for the cattle to stay on the ranch, basically.
I think Clay Conry's said it a couple times on Working Cows that, you know, that there's folks that keep the horses up front for the tourist, the cows around the house for the neighbors, and the sheep out back to pay for it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
So, well, Greg, have we left anything else on the table today? Any resources you want to share? Any place you want to send people? Anything you want to get off your chest? Any big talking points you got?
Anybody has questions about processing the? I follow the Niche Meat Processors Assistance Network email listserv. I think they're one of the best resources for anybody interested in direct marketing meat. Or especially for building or operating processing plants. And then I always recommend everybody join my daughter and I have a Facebook group, Politics from the Pastures. We like to discuss all of these issues around the big four that I brought up, the subsidies, the antitrust enforcement, the labeling issues, the inspection things, and any other issues globally that impact rural America, farmers, our food supply.
Great. And what's your Twitter handle? Just, I know what it is. I mean, we're friends, but tell me what it is so I can make sure I get it right in the show notes.
That's a good question. I'm not really, is it at G Gunthorpe? I'm not sure.
You know, I'll find out. I'll make sure I get your correct Twitter handle in the show.
Yeah, because I'm a much more civil and reserved person on Facebook than I am on Twitter. I like to drag everybody imaginable. If I've got an issue, I don't got no problem tagging the secretary and tagging a couple Federal Trade Commissioners and some you name it.
Twitter's where you go to get mad and sling poo at everybody.
Oh yeah. I kind of like it every once in a while. It's kind of fun. I'm sure some of them are like, is there a way to unfollow this Greg Gunthorpe guy?
Yeah. Where's that block button at?
Yeah. Right. But you know, legally they can't do that. Like the government speech, including the checkoff people. I have to point that out to them every once in a while too. So the National Pork Producers and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Trump got that Supreme Court thing, as long as it's government speech. And so they like to try to block a farmer every once in a while. And I'm like, nah, I don't think you can do that, because if you guys aren't government speech, those checkoffs are unconstitutional, because that's the only reason the Supreme Court said you guys could still be around. Probably better unblock them. Then tag the Ag Marketing Service to point it out to them at USDA. Be like, hey, can you check into this?
probably have a fan club over there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I need a few more so that we get a few more people raising hell with them.
Well, I'll come help you raise a little bit of hell on Twitter.
Okay, that'll be fun.
CK, do you have anything?
No, I'm interested to see how the supply shortage conversation plays out. I think that kind of like adversity through a lot of the ranches who have become successful is because they were forced to shut down or pivot their model. It's created more resiliency. So I'm really interested to see what the good side of things comes with supply shortages and people really kind of unveiling their food system. So
where there's opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
There's opportunity there. There's opportunities in the future, you know, for local food systems. Well, it's been a great episode. I think that's a good place to end. You guys have a great week. We'll catch you later.
Yeah. Thank you.